things we love here at Mill City is that we've got a team of people that teach here on Sunday mornings. And of course, Pastor Ashish and I love teaching, but we love to have different folks from our community, and every once in a while a guest come as well. But Joe is a part of our community here at Mill City and a part of our teaching team, and we're so grateful to have her here today. She's also one of my besties, I'm just being honest. I know. Aw, it's so great. It's so cute. I'm feeling a little salty about the eggnog thing that you're gonna say later.
I said what I said.
She said what she said. Who here likes eggnog? Okay, I'm just saying it's not okay. We've got difference of opinion. We've got a difference of opinion, but we stayed friends. See? You can be friends with your differences. Okay, I'm done. Joe is gonna continue our conversation, Light in the Darkness. Can you all welcome Joe Saxton?
Good morning, everybody. It's good to be with you. Hold on, I'm going to fix myself because I don't think I... Okay, it's too late now. Okay, it's all far too gone. So, favorite movies. I think there'll be a little selection on the screen on favorites. Anybody liked any of these? Yes. Yeah? There were those who have the Dickens vibe have two options here. You have The Muppet Christmas Carol, I think is the better one, or It's a Wonderful Life. I feel I should say I have watched it, but it's 3 hours, man, and that should be reserved for Marvel movies, in my opinion. Elf, anybody an Elf fan? I'm an Elf fan. You don't smell like Santa, you stink. You smell of beef and cheese. That's my, smiling's my favorite. The quotes go on. And I put this Christmas down there simply because it talks about a big, sprawling family with lots of dysfunction. There are many movies that are the kind of family dysfunction movies. Now, I love, love, love Christmas movies, but I'm currently, because I want to keep it fresh, I'm currently into a genre. Not just a Christmas movie, but a Christmas genre of movies. And that is Hallmark. Yeah. Or Hallmark adjacent. You know what I mean. They are terrible. They are fabulous. I don't know the title of any of them. They are all the same. But let me tell you, they are perfect because they're entertaining. And for those of us who have not been blessed with Hallmark, let me give you a vibe. Attractive city person with fancy clothes and fancy shoes, boots, shiny, often a lot of hair product, is forced by one reason or another to go to small town. When they reach said small town, they see other equally attractive people wearing green or red, plaid, flannel, that kind of thing. A little bit like a number of you this morning. Glorious, glorious. Those people are good with their hands. He fells trees. She bakes cookies. Whatever happens, sometimes there is a child involved who has a lot of attitude. But what happens is city person realizes their life is empty and hard and painful. And because of meeting person in red, green, or plaid, discovers that life is now worth living. And they have found the magic of Christmas. We don't really know what that magic is. No one really describes it. It could be a candle. It could be a tree. It could be the way that they sing Silent Night off key when they are gathered around this community square with the fake snow. But what has happened is that city person is now transformed by the green, plaid, red, beautiful person. And they all live. See, it's perfect. Everything has changed. Everything has changed, and it's wonderful. And you know that's exactly how you meet the person of your dreams. You know it. You know that's how it is. Isn't that what we all wanted? That's not how I met my husband. I didn't meet him in the perfect... Well, it was perfect. I wasn't wearing green. He wasn't wearing red. My roommate put in a good... Actually, that makes it a whole different story. My roommate asked me to put in a good word for her with him. I know, but she was our wedding photographer. It was fine. In the end. Anyway, perfect is different in different ways, isn't it? And if only the red and green and plaid was real. But it's a fantasy, it's a caricature, and Christmas isn't often that transformative. You see, if Christmas was that perfect, there wouldn't be eggnog. Yeah, I said it. And that was going to be my community question. My community question was going to be eggnog. Why? That was going to be the question. Why? And my daughter said I wasn't allowed to do that. She said it was discriminatory and I wasn't allowed. So I didn't. I'd listen to you. I did what you said, kiddo. But why? And also, why, instead of being called eggnog, why isn't it called Christmas phlegm? That's what it should be called. That's what it should be called. I'm just saying. I said what I said anyway. So that is just one little example of a non-picture perfect Christmas. But the reality is, we all know very well that that small town, big city or otherwise, it's not perfect. It's not perfect at all. In fact, it's LendingTree that say that 1/3 of Americans will go into debt just to pay for all the things. Just to pay for all the things. The American Psychological Association say that 9 out of 10 Americans say that financial concerns, family conflict, missing loved ones adds and increases to the stress. I would say that 1 out of 10 was a liar because it's probably all of us who feel those things. 43% of the people they surveyed said that the pressures they feel affect how much they enjoy Christmas. 36% of the people they surveyed said that they felt like the holidays was a competition. There's an anecdote amongst a number of attorneys that call January divorce month, and where Christmas has been the last straw. Those who are subject and oppressed by relationship violence can be particularly vulnerable around the holiday season. The excessive alcohol, the increase in stress, the pressure can cause things to spiral. But even if we are having a wonderful and a peaceful and peace-filled Christmas in our homes and in our families, if we pull back the camera and look at things on a global scale, we know it's not that way. Just one look at the news or the news that we're avoiding will remind us of that. And it's situation after situation, Ukraine, Congo, Sudan, Hamas, Gaza, Israel, all of these things that we don't even always know what to feel about them, but they are part of the landscape of a non-picture-perfect world. And while we're in the middle of working out how we should think or respond in some ways, there's a study by the International Institute of Strategic Studies, and they're an organization that explore global security, political risk, and military conflict. And they said right now at this moment, there are 183 regional conflicts on Earth. We just got the ones that reached the top of the news cycle. 183, the highest level in 30 years. So what do we have left? It's no wonder in many ways that we go for the escape into entertainment, the escape into a fantasy that we try and design a picture-perfect Christmas. We shouldn't be surprised that instead of hope, people will go for toxic positivity or a fantasy, that instead of peace, that we'll go for numbing or, I was going to say control or managing things, what we mean control, or that instead of joy that we've sung of, we go for our overindulgence. But maybe one of the sadder things is that the actual Christmas story can sometimes become something of a caricature too. A sanitized series of events where they're empty characters with very little meaning. Where we have a silent baby, no crying he makes. Not the introduction. I think of that, I'm like, Lord, could that be our Christmas miracle? Maybe there are some of us praying. No crying. Jesus born sleeping through the night. No crying he makes, but not the introduction of the one who will transform the course of human history. Not the one who is the light that pierces and splinters the darkness. And it can leave us wondering, what does said silent baby mean for my personal life, for my career, for my relationships, for my story? And honestly, when I think of the society at large, I don't think we really need to get offended when someone's saying happy holidays. Do you know what I mean? At least they're saying happy. I don't know that we need to get worried about that and get uptight about people like, have we taken the Christ out of Christ? I get it. I mean, have you read the news? You can see why. But perhaps we might want to be devastated that somehow the realization of how powerful and transformative and how meaningful Jesus is hasn't quite got through. Because what we've seen as we've journeyed together this Advent is that the presence of Jesus changes everything, means everything. That light in the darkness does mean that transformation for our lives, for our communities, for our relationships, for our world. So what I want to do in the time we have together is to look at another passage around the Christmas story. And we're going to explore how different groups respond to the light breaking into the darkness and then ask ourselves some questions about it. And so to do that, I'm going to be looking at the Magi. I'm going to read from Matthew, the passage, the whole passage is Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 through 12, but I'm going to go like 3 or 4 verses at a time. So I'll start with Matthew chapter 2, verses 1 and 2. After Jesus was born in Bethlehem in Judea, during the time of King Herod, Magi from the east came to Jerusalem and asked, "Where is the one who has been born King of the Jews? We saw his star when it rose and we have come to worship him." Magi, talk about a caricature. Talk about a fantasy. I don't know who you grew up seeing when you were described, when you heard, maybe you were told there were three kings. Maybe at the pageants that you attended, were encouraged to go to, were participating in, you saw these three kings dressed in jewel tones. Three names, Melchior, Caspar, and Belshazzar, a multi-ethnic crew to span the world. And they kind of glided in, and someone was got to be the camel and then glided out. And that was their thing, bringing their gifts. I also have questions about how wise they are. If I could have that next slide up, please. If there had been three wise women instead, diapers, formula, casseroles. Just saying. Or maybe you'd ask other questions about the gold, frankincense, and myrrh. Like, what does... I mean, the gold makes sense. It's money and all of that. But the question of, do these gifts do anything for this child's cognitive development? Are these gifts child-proofed? And most importantly of all, where is Elmo on these gifts? Make it make sense. I can't see it here. But when we get to the actual story of these Magi, we see something different. Yes, from the east, and most scholars who are still trying to tease out the specifics understand these people coming from Persia and that they were astrologers and astronomers, perhaps servants of a Persian king. The study of the stars was a big thing. And their understanding in that part of the world was that the world was so connected and so interconnected that if something happened in the sky, if something significant happened in the sky, it had implications. It was reflecting something significant that was happening on Earth, something incredible happening. So they saw something, and they discerned that it was divine and that they had to pursue it. Light had broken into the darkness and lit up the sky in a different way. And they understood where the direction it was coming from, and they needed to find out more. And they discerned there was a new king. And so this group, we don't know if it was three or not, travel across the region. And depending on, some scholars say it was a 40-day trip, some say 4 to 5 month trip. Either way, it took effort and intention. They saw the sign and they responded. It wasn't a secret sign, it was there in the sky for everybody to see. It's just that they moved towards it. The light was evident, breaking into the darkness, but they actually acted on it. And the first question I want us to reflect on for ourselves, when we think of these this group of people who may not have known all the full detail, but they knew that they needed light in their darkness, and they knew they needed to respond to it, a question for ourselves is, where do you need God's light to break into the darkness in your life? Where do you need his light to break in? I don't know if you've had a sign or if you've had an inkling that something needs a change. When I was about 18, I said to the Lord on my 18th birthday, I'm just going to see how I can do without you for a while. It's not me, it's you. And decided to move on from him. And then a number of months later, I grew up in inner city London, and I remember seeing a sunset. I've always been one who is moved by sunrises and sunsets. And I remember seeing a sunset on the apartment blocks that we grew up in. And I remember saying out loud, I've backed the wrong horse, haven't I? God understood the gambling reference. He's expansive vocabulary and all. But this sense of, oh no, what have I done? Who am I entrusting my life to? It took a while after that, but it was the beginning of a change. I don't know whether there has been a set of circumstances, a set of relationships, or something, or whether it's just something you've been thinking about, but where do you need God's light to break into the darkness of your life? It might be for you personally. It may be in your relationships. There may be some relationships in your life which are at the end, and they are, as far as you're concerned, you are all out of hope and all out of joy and all out of peace. And you need God to break in for you there. Maybe it's at work in some way. I'd encourage us to reflect upon that this Advent. In the same way that these magi were seeking and longing for God, what does it look like for you? But when we look at the text, that's not the only response to the light. Like I said, it was out there in the sky for everyone to see, but not everybody picked up in the same way. I'll read on from verse 3 when Herod gets involved. When King Herod heard this, he was disturbed, and all Jerusalem with him. When he had called together all the people's chief priests and the teachers of the law, he asked them where the Messiah was to be born. In Bethlehem in Judea, they replied, for this is what the prophet has written. But you, Bethlehem, in the land of Judah, are by no means least amongst the rulers of Judah. For out of you will come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel. Then Herod called the Magi secretly and found out from them the exact time the star had appeared. He sent them to Bethlehem and said, go and search carefully for the child. As soon as you find him, report to me, so that I too may go and worship him. Introducing Herod the Great, as he was known. Very powerful man. He was, in some ways, oversaw great architecture. There were amphitheaters built, temples to emperors, also the largest, most glamorous, large temple for God's people in Jerusalem. But he also ruled by brutal suppression. He was determined to hold on to power at any cost. Herod the Great was the one who, if there was a direct threat to his power, he would deal with it. He killed his 3 sons. He killed his mother-in-law. He killed his wife. He killed anybody who was deemed a threat or an enemy to having total and utter control. And so when the light breaks in, Herod is disturbed by it, because this is one that is somehow beyond reach, seemingly beyond reach. It's a direct threat to power. When I hear that moment, I hear the echoes of Luke chapter 2, where Mary offers what's known as the Magnificat, where she talks about how he has brought rulers down from their thrones. And it's almost like the gong sounds at the birth of Jesus. You may have power now, but the day is coming. There's a new king in town. The world is about to change. And so Herod seeks to manipulate the Magi, find out the location, and take care of things, so that there is no threat to the control and the power he has. Now, it's a bit awkward, isn't it, working out how we apply Herod to our lives? No Herods in the building here, and for which we're very thankful, because it would be awkward, and we'd all run and leave. Light in the dark is a good thing. It's transformational, except when you want to control things. You know when the light goes on and you want it on, it's great. But when you're in the dark and the light goes on suddenly, you kind of push back a little. You blink, you cover your eyes. It's just too much, too fast. There is a transformation that's on offer that will turn a world upside down. Herod doesn't want his world turned upside down. I wonder for you and I whether we are really up for this transformation, whether we're really up for this light to shine on every part of our lives. I mean, if he could shine the light on the things that we want him to do, fine. But what about the things that we're like, you could leave that alone, thank you very much. I did not invite you here. You are not a guest in this house. Those parts. Maybe the areas that we want to manage, and by when I say manage, I mean control. Maybe the areas which we're afraid of our lives. Maybe there are areas that we don't want the light in because we're ashamed or we're afraid and it's just too much. And so I ask us this question to consider, where are we resistant to the light? Where do we like, God, you don't have permission to meddle with that part of my story. Don't ask me to forgive. Don't ask me to let you in on this. or I'm just so ashamed, I can't bring this to you. Let me come back to you when I'm perfect and I've got myself together. Let me fix this, and then you can like me again. We don't sing that or don't say that because it doesn't roll off the tongue. When the band are leading us, that just doesn't come out there. Lord, when I'm better for you, I will worship. But that's half the time what we're thinking. Lord, when I've got myself together, it's on. And we don't realize in doing that, we're actually resisting the light. Because we're afraid of its harshness and not of the warmth of its glow. If the light of God could transform the darkness in your relationships at work, in your careers, in your own story, in your past, present, and future, what might you do? When we don't know, it's a bit intimidating, isn't it? There's another set of people who are part of this story, the religious leaders and the learners, and they actually had more information than the Magi. They knew he was coming. They knew where he was going to be. They knew where this king was going to show up. But they too were disturbed. They too were kind of freaked out by these people saying, so where's the king? Woo, let's go. And understandable, Herod the Great is great at not some good things. Understandable because the Romans have oppressed them for many, many years. This disruption is terrible. But when we look at the story of the religious leaders throughout the Gospels, we see a consistent thread. They wanted a king. They wanted the king of the Jews to come. They wanted the Messiah. Their people had been waiting 400 years where they'd had oppressor, exchange for another oppressor, exchange for another oppressor. They wanted it, but they had expectations of what that Messiah would be like. And this wasn't going to fit. This guy walking around the Galilean countryside, healing people, speaking truth to power, just was not going to fit. How was that meant to handle the Romans? They wanted someone who was going to take care of business. They'd kind of made a Messiah in the image of their longings and their hurts and their hopes and their fears, which is entirely understandable. But it meant that when the light came, it was as though they were in a completely different direction. And they were so myopic, they couldn't receive it. Because it didn't look like what they anticipated. It didn't look like who they expected. It didn't look like how they expected. And so it's not so much that they were resistant to the light, but they had expectations of light that would break into their darkness, that would splinter the pain and the agony and the brokenness and the systemic realities on their terms. I wonder where you and I want to receive the light of Christ, the transformative power of God that breaks into our darkness, but we are only prepared to do that if God will do it on our terms. And there are many ways we can do this. Maybe bargaining. Like, I love to bargain with the Lord. I think it's fun. It gets me nowhere, but hope springs eternal. So, for example, on my 40th birthday, I said to the Lord, Lord, you know I love you. You know what's coming. What I would like, I think you can give me a gift for my birthday. I would like a faster metabolism, please. Now, I don't know if heaven laughs at you, but if it did, I think I heard it that day. I'm just saying. Those were the things I wanted, things on my terms. Maybe there are some old arguments with God. Maybe we won't want to receive the light of Christ because we have expectations. There ain't nothing to mess your life up than expectations. There ain't nothing to mess up your Christmas like expectations. You know your family is crazy. Yeah? You know they put the fun in dysfunction. You know these things. And yet somehow you go towards these gatherings anticipating that maybe this could be the year when it's going to be different. It ain't going to be different. It's going to be the same. You're like, Lord, could this be the time? And we go hoping that we say something, we lead people to conversations that we think will be better. They ain't going to be better. Why? Because they ain't changed. And we're still expecting things to be better. They're not going to uncrazy for Christmas, are they? They're like, I know, let me just put my craziness to the side because it's Christmas. No, they're going to drink Red Bull on it. Supersize it, set fire to it, and let's go. That's what happens at Christmas. I think it does. And then we come to the Lord, we're like, Lord, it was hard. And he's like, you think? Because we hoped it would happen on our terms. That family member would turn around and say to us, you were right all along. I do need to do what you tell me to do. I do need to do it the way you tell me to do it. And we expect these things, and we'll demonstrate a little humility, false humility, but it's there. A little humility with them. That's what we anticipated. Or maybe we have become so consumed with how we think it should be, how things should be done, that we can't see that God is right here. Just not on the terms you anticipated. And we might miss out on the things that God is trying to do because it didn't come in the packaging we'd hoped. I wonder where we want to receive the light of Christ on our terms. And then finally, in verses 9 through 12, when the Magi meet Jesus. After they'd heard the king, they went on their way, and the star they had seen when it rose went ahead of them until it stopped over the place where the child was. When they saw the star, they were overjoyed. On coming to the house, they saw the child with his mother Mary, and they bowed down and worshipped him. Then they opened their treasures and presented him with gifts of gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And having been warned in a dream not to go back to Herod, they returned to their country by another route. I'm amazed at the tenacity of the Magi. They were proactive. They were persistent. They saw this star and they didn't understand it all, but they knew God was in it. In the limited understanding they had, they pursued God with all they had. And it took time and it took effort and it took resources and energy. It took weeks, it took months, but they got there. It wasn't going to be a quick microwave version of God meeting them. But when they got to the end, they encountered the living God. They were transformed by the encounter with the living God. And so, yeah, they were joyful because they met with God. Yes, they bow down in worship because at the end of this journey of seeking and searching, they lived and met with God. And these gifts of gold and frankincense and myrrh, it was kind of the common custom to give those to royalty, to give those to people of prestige. But from the days of the early church and the ancient church until now, those gifts have been seen to have a prophetic, symbolic significance. That the gold represented royalty. That the frankincense represented a priestly nature and a deity and acts of worship. And the myrrh was a foreshadowing of who Jesus would ultimately be for the world. And I'm struck by the fact that the passage says they opened up their treasures. They gave something of themselves. They made a response to this light that broke into the darkness. It wasn't an intellectual response, It wasn't solely an intellectual response. It was a whole life response. And I ask us, how will we respond to the light of Christ? To him breaking into the darkness? To his work on the cross, his life, death, and resurrection? How will we respond this day? What will it mean for our lives and how we do life this day? If the band could come up, that'd be great. If you read the rest of the story, you know it doesn't end with jazz hands of happiness. It's still dark. Herod is bitter and unleashed. Evil unfolds. Joseph has to take the family to another country and rearrange their lives for years. And in some ways, to go back to where we began, the reality is we still live in a context which is in desperate need of transformation. 183 countries, regional conflicts, mass debt, pressure, stress, vulnerability, pasts we can't get past, heartbreak and heartache. We need the light. We need the light for us, but also we need to see that light in our communities. And it's interesting, as Jesus grows up, one of the ways he describes his followers is that they were to be light. That they were light. And so I think it's important for us also to ask, where is God inviting you to be light to the world around you, to be a light in the dark in the world around you? As we journey together this Advent, as we come towards Christmas Day and all the fun things, I invite you to consider these questions again. Where do you need God's light to break into the darkness in your own life? I invite you to ask yourself again, where are we resistant to the light? I invite you to consider again, where do we want to receive the light of Christ on our terms? To consider again, how will we respond to the light of Christ? And finally, where is God extending an invitation to you to be light in the darkness in the world around you? Let me just pray for us. Lord, we want to thank you for breaking into the darkness. We thank you for changing the course of history. But Lord, we simply ask this, that you would show each of us our next step. That you'd speak to us about our world today, right here, right now. And that your light would shine and bring the transformation that we need. In Jesus' name.